Welcome to the Business of Security podcast brought to you by TrustMap for Security Performance Management. Your hosts today are Chad Beckman and Malcolm Harkins. Today they talk with Miguel Ilacas, Global CISO with Cantor Fitzgerald. Now let's get to it.
Welcome to the Business of Security podcast. This is your host, Chad Beckman, and joining me as always is Malcolm Harkins. And in this episode, we have a special guest, Miguel Ilacas. We are talking about transitioning a security program as a CISO. What does that look like? What are the different work streams involved? What are the different data points that need to be shared to the predecessor? And with the CISO attrition at anywhere between 2 to 4 years, depending on what analysts and research you follow, this is a very hot topic, and so we're going to dive right in here. At first, Miguel, give us a little background about yourself.
Yeah, so thank you for hosting me, Chad and Malcolm. So my name again is Miguel Ilacas. I am a technology leader with over 20 years of experience. Recently, I have been under the News Corp umbrella for about 10 years or so. You know, I started through an acquisition of an education software company, where I was the CIO and CISO. Then it was divested, and I moved over to the parent company, News Corp. I worked there to create shared cybersecurity services across the dozen or so businesses that they have, you know, worldwide. And then I ended my run there as the CISO of Dow Jones. And I'm now transitioning over to a global Wall Street financial services firm, as their global CISO, you know, and I'm super excited of starting, you know, that new phase in my career, and, you know, thinking about all the processes and all the things that I have to do to be able to take over that security program of the new organization, right? And, you know, making it even more mature than where it is today.
Excellent. What an exciting opportunity for you. So as you began to transition out of the Dow Jones and shore up and hand over any of the information necessary to the team, existing team, and perhaps your predecessor, can you walk us through a little bit about what that process looks like?
Yeah, so that's interesting. So there's two parts here, right? One is me leaving my previous position, where I have to make sure that all the documents and assets that I've, you know, collected over my time there are set in a way that it's easy for the next person, the next team, you know, to take over, right? Unfortunately, there's not one, say, tool or one simple way of doing that. I think that, you know, at least in my experience and from talking to other colleagues, the most common, you know, practice is, you know, collect a lot of documents, either it's Word documents or it's Google documents, put them all in one folder, and then share that with whoever's going to be taking over after you, right? Hopefully, if you've done you've been disciplined across your time at the organization, you've been already shaping these artifacts, right, in a way that it's easy to communicate over to your team, right? Because of course, as a CISO, you want to make sure that each one of your you know, team members know what you're going to be doing, and, you know, where are the source of information that they should get in case they need to make a decision or know what the current policy is or the latest version, right? Sometimes in some companies, you are able to have an intranet, and it makes it everything is centralized on that intranet. I would say more on the tech side versus maybe more established organizations where they still have a lot of files that are being emailed around, right? So when you have all that information, and if you've been disciplined enough, it makes them so much more simpler to transition over the program. But I've seen the opposite, where when I'm taking over a program, maybe all those artifacts are scattered across, or they've been ad hoc, or maybe the methodology to be used hasn't been like a standard methodology. Or sometimes they bring over consultants and contractors that they own their own proprietary methodology to be able to track the maturity of your cybersecurity program. So then you have to do this transition around how do you map it to more well-known frameworks, and then how do you take that to, you know, where you want to take it or where the organization wants to take it.
What have you seen as the biggest challenge recently in educating the team upon your departure? Was it simply ensuring that all the information you were aware of was in a single location or reference document, perhaps links and so on? That was sort of like a, call it a homeowner's manual for the security program. Is that typically how you've transitioned the security posture in the past?
I'd say the biggest challenge for the team is knowing how much of the vision is going to be changing. So everybody, you know, has their own styles and possibly goals that they have agreed with, or with their steering committees or with the executive team. And when, you know, there's a change of leadership, the new person might come with you know, different ideas or different, you know, needs depending on the time of, you know, the business. Especially now we can see, for example, with COVID, there's probably a lot of changes happening at many organizations. So when the team sees this thing happening, right, they're wondering, am I working on the right thing, or should I be maybe focusing on something, you know, different? I see that's the, you know, the largest challenge outside of anything that you have documented. And that's why, as I mentioned before, it's so important to have, you know, standard or well-known frameworks to be able to base your security program to make it much easier for the next person or the team to know what are the future objectives are going to be, just because, you know, these are well-established, you know, frameworks that are being used.
Yeah, I relay that to, you know, instead of a 1,000-yard sprint, it becomes more of a relay race, handing that baton to the next runner so they can pick up right where the previous runner left off and continue down the track. I think your approach is a sound one. By following a standard framework, of course, and understanding and aligning priorities to the business, that certainly helps with that translation or that transition, making that transition much easier. Malcolm, when you've held these roles in the past, what are some strategies that you've employed for transitioning over to your predecessor?
Yeah, you know, and it's, I look at it a little bit different. And so again, let's walk this out into a broader context of succession planning, right? In almost every large organization, even small ones, right? You know, the CEO, the CFO, the general counsel, all those executive roles have a level of talent management, right? And succession planning that's built in. I grew up that way at Intel, right? I was there for 24 years. And I saw those smooth transitions because it was all around talent management. So I did that same thing within my team and for myself. So that way, if one of my key staff members left, changed roles, got hit by a bus, whatever, you know, hopefully nothing unfortunate happens, but those things do happen, right? And so it's a succession planning issue. And I always had to put myself in a position where if I disappeared, the mission would continue. And I did that in multiple times when I was running security at Intel, where I got on to special projects because I had to. Sarbanes-Oxley came up. I had to leave my security stuff for a year to go help address the Sarbanes-Oxley control issues. And I took two of my staff, made them two in a box, complementary skills, and I basically disappeared. And I chatted with them once a week and I said, you run this, I got to go do this. And if you need help, holler. Or when Intel was sued with antitrust, I had to go deal with all the e-discovery issues and build an e-discovery team. Basically ignored my team. They ran by themselves. And then when I ended up leaving Intel, Brent Conran, who's still there, who took a sub portion of my role as chief information security officer, when Intel decided to eliminate the chief security and privacy officer role, he had been at McAfee. He had covered my sabbatical. So he had basically run my job for a 10-week period. And then when I left several months later, it was an easy transition. Right. When I was at Cylance and then Blop by BlackBerry. And when I left, John McClurg, former Dell chief security officer who came to work at Cylance, who was working for me doing external influence, he took over as BlackBerry's chief information security officer. So I think we have to look at it more broadly. And I think the thing that I've seen in the industry is our organizations at a corporate level are not doing a good job of talent management in the security team. Hence, there's these big disruptions and swings. And some of that could be, I want a change of vision, a change of strategy, or some of it might be, we're just doing a lousy job of talent management.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. So one of the, first goals that I always tell people that join my team, especially managers or leaders in my team, is that they need to look for their number two, right? That one person that's going to be able to replace them or help them or assist them, right? And that would allow them to be able to move into other areas that the business needs them to move into without, you know, jeopardizing their current area, right? And I think that follows through the same, I think.
It's creating that bench capability so that way you've got always an obvious number two and maybe another person, right? So that way, again, but I think what happens, unfortunately, too frequently is when CISOs leave, they then, in essence, go pull from their prior team and suck them into their next role, right? So there's no, for lack of a better word, loyalty to their previous organization in some cases to make sure their mission of security or privacy continues.
You get the brain drain, as they say, in the talent pool. Yeah, that happens so frequently. And, that I think can be prevented by, in my opinion, having a very well-documented security program, back to what we spoke about earlier, understanding what those priorities are, assuming they're aligned to very well understood industry frameworks and, you know, compliance offshoots as a result. If it's well articulated, well documented, and it makes sense where anybody that's been in this industry for more than 5 years could probably walk in and manage it, that's what I would say, I would consider personally, a well-managed, well-documented security program. And I think the point was made that I'd like to talk about a little bit earlier was the around priorities, which is a little bit of perception and a little bit of culture as well, right? Because you can have a little, you can have some influence from outside parties or adjacent parties that may want to say, you know, we shouldn't be prioritizing these efforts or these risks. We should be focusing on those efforts or those risks instead. And so that becomes, it's kind of a separate discussion, but it also becomes an important item when you talk about stepping in and running the program and understanding how you hand that baton over smoothly versus restarting, you know? So how do you, I want to kind of dive into that. How do you manage the culture as a new CISO coming in without getting bombarded from everyone's opinions based on what is in front of you today, right?
Yeah, I think there's maybe two parts to that question. Or one is you want to be able to figure out who is your main stakeholder right at the beginning to be able to tackle that one little hanging fruit that maybe that VIP stakeholder has. And at the same time, develop what is the mid to long-term roadmap. Or the priorities that you're going to be tackling. So the reason why I say that is you want to create that first impression that you are able to be effective and that you have everything under control. And sometimes you get that from maybe somebody's higher up opinion. And then as you can learn more across the organization of what are the needs, what are the business issues, and what are things you should be tackling more mid and long term, like again, right? And show them that you've been effective already with something maybe that low hanging fruit, and that now you're going to be shifting the team or the the energy toward these other goals that have been, say, blessed or approved by the the management of the company.
The question that comes to mind immediately, Miguel, is: do you trust the the former security leader walking in? You know, is there a checklist to say that makes sense, that makes sense, that makes sense, that doesn't. Is there some kind of rule of the road to say, what do I trust that was already done and what do I need to redo or validate?
Yeah, so part of it is, as a technologist, especially I remember when I was much more inexperienced, you would always come in and just say, oh, that's, you know, bad, and I have a new way of doing it, right? I think we've all been in that situation. And maybe you see it with you know, more inexperienced members today when you join into the team. You know, in a much more mature situation today, you go into any company and you always, you know, leave the benefit of doubt that maybe that was the right thing to do at that point in time, right? And that maybe today it's not the right thing anymore to be done, and make sure you know, convince your stakeholders, your leadership, to be able to pivot into the direction that you think you should take the company to.
Yeah, Miguel, I think you make a really good point there. I learned back in my Intel days from one of my team members who was one of the managers, long-term InfoSec person. And again, I had portions of this in the early days. And then when I came back from the Sarbanes-Oxley and bringing all the information risk and security stuff together in late 2004, early 2005, let's just say my management and leadership skills were not as tuned to what they should have been. And I was highly frustrated with prior decisions and approaches or leaving risk issues. And so I'd be like, what dumbass, that was a good idea and stuff like that. And let's just say it created my frustrations. I wasn't managing it very well. Jersey, who was one of the team members who was now reporting to me, came down to Folsom, sat me down in the cafeteria and basically lectured me I was better than that. And I realized at that moment that I should have respected the past. I might have a different view, but I think that's also the other thing that we sometimes don't do when we're in these transitions is respect the past, because the organization was still there and a lot of people had participated in those prior decisions. Some of the management team that worked for me, and I was just bad mouthing it. And luckily he taught me a lesson that day that hopefully I'll carry forward. But that's also, I think, a key component that you were talking about. You might have a different view, but how you handle that different view and do it hopefully with respect will also ease, I think, in the transition and then the change management, so to speak, to the new vision and new vectors that we're trying to put in place.
I think I want to use the word, like, dangerous situation you can be in is if you end up in making the same decision as they made in the past, right? After you criticize it.
Exactly. Been there, done that a couple times.
Exactly. And then, you know, other people, you know, just lose faith on you. Maybe the other part of the question to answer there is having, I think all of us, when we start a new job as a CISO, we have this playbook. You know, I think more and more of the trend is to do like the 100 days playbook, where you learn about the company as somebody from outside, and then you learn about the company by talking to everybody inside. You try to figure out what all the assets are, you know, what are you protecting, what's the value of everything, and then you come up with a risk ranking methodology, and you start doing, you know, risk assessments across all these assets and from what you learn from the company, and you create the roadmap, right? I think that process is what I think a lot of us have in our heads and or scattered ad hoc documents everywhere. I haven't seen, you know, anywhere out there in the market that makes that simpler yet. And I think that's where, you know, some I think tools have been useful to, if you start using them and your predecessor and start, you know, were using it before, it would be really nice to have something like that where you can, you know, in one spot or in one method, be able to have all that data already, see what others had in the past, and be able to, you know, pivot them to the future and still have that all documented. I think that would be, you know, very useful. I don't know. What are your thoughts, Malcolm and Chad?
Yeah, no, I think it's incredibly useful to do that, as you said, and that also provides a level of transparency that again makes it easier for everybody to know how you're thinking of evolving it. I, at the same time, I think, you know, having frameworks are useful. I know, and I've seen some peers that rigidly follow them versus use them as a guide? Because I think every organization is different. Every culture is a little bit different. And so how you apply the framework, you know, in my perspective, would take into account some of those nuances. Again, and if you're going into a situation where there really hasn't been much of a program or it's really broken, it's different than doing something that was doing pretty well and reasonably mature, and you're just evolving it to the next level. So depending upon that type of maturation of the team and the metrics and measurements they have, you're going to have more lifting to do or tearing down of certain things and rebuilding it. So I think all of those things kind of play into how you apply the frameworks.
Yeah, I think the ideal situation is if you go in and maybe the organization is at a, I'm just, you know, as an example, at a level two for CMMI, and the company wants to move it to a level three or four, being able to use that already, right, as a base, that would be, ideal situation there, right?
Yeah, and again, they might have all the right components, but there might just be a lethargic structure and operations there because, you know, the executive team, the CIO, the prior CISO, whatever, didn't have that strong sense of passion or purpose, and they got their wake-up call, right? And now you've got to instill energy and movement and outcomes quickly, right? And those things again take a different type of leadership style while you're applying the frameworks than just incremental improvement approach.
You make a good point that I want to dive into quickly is, as a new incoming security leader, whether you have the official CISO title or not, I think there's a sense of urgency upon that new individual coming in to lead the program where that person feels like they have to make change in order to substantiate their position and their capabilities, right? Kind of almost proving themselves to the organization. And I'm curious that if that has an impact on some of the priorities, right? Are we as security leaders, are we wanting to make changes for the sake of changes, perhaps where the roadmap prior was sufficient? Do either of you ever see that occurring in with your peers or hear of stories of that with customers or in any other context?
I've seen it more on, I would say, on the more, junior levels where, something new, shiny comes out and they want to try it. Right. And then it's our, I think, mandate as leaders to be able to curb those, let's say, proof of concepts, right? So you want to be able to enable some change and be able to investigate what are the new trends that are out there. That way you're on top of your game. But if you realize that it's not something crucial for the organization, then be able to, coach and mentor your team to, let them know that maybe that's not the best thing, the decision to move forward, or even better, give them all the information necessary for them to reach that conclusion, right? And of course, I think there's probably a lot of leaders, not only on the CISO role and other roles, that want to do changes just for the sake of change. I think what I mentioned before was, for example, being able to resolve a need of the company quickly when you start at a new organization, trying to find that one low-hanging fruit that could introduce you to the company. I think for me, it's crucial, but not just doing it if there's no need to do that.
Yeah, I agree with you completely, Miguel. And I think, and I do think it can sometimes happen at a more junior level, though I've seen and heard from peers that are certainly more senior, they've been more seasoned, they are part of that, crowd that will, move jobs every few years, and they kick up a lot of dust. Right. And I think as an industry, we many times confuse motion from progress because we're not really focused on the outcomes. We're not really delivering true performance management to business objective. It's like, I bought this tool, I implemented this thing, I hit this control objective and stuff like that. And you go, have we really delivered outcomes on risk, total cost, and business velocity for other parts of the business or the customer journeys. And I think, again, sometimes we, again, you get all this motion and we have metrics of motion versus really metrics and performance towards real outcomes that are meaningful to the business.
Yeah, and that's the, I think, a very bad scenario where, let's say, security teams, your leadership is doing security changes for security's sake and not for business need, right, or business requirements. That's a pretty muddy situation there.
Yeah, that's why I always believed in the saying, you know, aligning security to the business, because at the end of the day, the business is in business to be in business, right? And to be profitable in most cases. We're in security to enable that mission and those visions, not in the business of security to just secure everything down. And I think to Malcolm, your point, I've seen a number of instances of, you know, the proverbial kicking up the dust, making, you know, creating change for the sake of change, not necessarily fits into maybe the vision and the strategy of the business and the key business outcomes. It appears to me, based on this discussion, our industry and particularly the office of the CISO could almost use a standard playbook for documenting, building a standard roadmap and handing, you know, making it very continuous in nature so that anyone can step into the role and simply begin operating, right? Making fine tuning as necessary. But, you know, if 4 years, let's say, has been invested by a previous CISO, obviously something was working if they were there for that long. And we should step in and, you know, to again, Malcolm, to your point, is respect the past and make incremental changes as the business is adjusting to the market. I'd like to see a standard like that, you know, published by some industry organization, whether it be NIST or anyone else for that matter. I think that's a gap in our industry, almost a standard playbook for managing and operating a security program.
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, again, you go look at it from a business, right? The strategy might change, the product line might change, your ecosystem partnerships and channel strategy might change, but you have a P&L, right? You know how much cash, you know the inventory, you know the liabilities, you know the revenue, you know accounts receivable. There's the P&L framework that doesn't change. The strategy and how you play within that to maximize net income might differ, but at the end of the day, you have that accounting structure that provides a continuity of really assessing, are you doing well or not, right?
Yeah, ultimately performance management. That's why, you know, I'm so passionate about that topic, security performance management. We need the same for information security, cybersecurity, as we do for other aspects of the business that have been managing performance management for years. And that's I think that's ultimately what we're talking about today in this discussion, is how do we do performance management with security much better? So Miguel, as you begin to look forward to your next opportunity, sounds like a very exciting one. Are there any key actions that you already have planned to, you know, make your first 100 days successful?
Yeah, you started even before starting, right? Just reviewing the company, I think I mentioned it before, as somebody from outside, what can you learn about it, right? Not only as a adversary view, but also just as a, you know, someone that is not part of the company, right? And then that way you could get some ideas already form of maybe the needs of the organization. Also, you know, you want to look into established organizations that are that cater towards the industry you're working for, right? If, you know, financial services is very well established, and as you both, I think, mentioned, even in the finance world and accounting world, all that is already fairly established. Cybersecurity, there's a lot of cybersecurity programs that have been maybe created and or determined due to financial services market. Getting to know what are the best practices out there for them? You know, what are maybe the myths that sometimes you get from being an outsider, and then comparing that to, you know, what you learn once you're at the job, right? And from the requirements that you gather from the business.
Well said. Appreciate your sharing your thoughts and insight today, both of you, as seasoned CISOs. That means a lot. And I think we can take this as almost a template and sort of a learning lesson on how to transition a security program, but also how to prepare as you step into a new role at a new organization to run that security posture. So any closing thoughts, Malcolm or Miguel, on the topic of transitioning a security program, anything that you'd like to leave the listeners with?
Yeah, you know, it's a leadership issue at the end of the day, and your title will determine and make you a manager, but your people will determine if you're a leader. And again, if you're not doing that talent management, that succession planning, and again, making those transitions smooth for the organization you're leaving, the organization you're going into, or the respective teams, then you're not doing your job and you're not leading.
Yeah, and being able to set those objectives and metrics that could last even longer than oneself. That way, their entire organization are used to them and are able to improve on them. Right? That would be, you know, crucial to be able to mature any security program.
Well said. Well said. The overall arching theme here today was the continuity of the security program. So thank you both for your time and your insights. It was a great discussion. And until next time.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chad.
Thank you for listening to the Business of Security podcast brought to you by TrustMap. We want to hear from our listeners. If you have a topic you'd like to discuss in the podcast or would like to continue the conversation, please connect with us on Twitter at CyberSecPodcast or email us at businessofsecurity@trustsds.com. We want to extend a special thank you to today's guest, Miguel Ilacas. Our hosts today were Chad Beckman, founder of TrustMap, and Malcolm Harkins, Chief Security and Trust Officer at Cymatic. You can connect with both Chad and Malcolm on LinkedIn and learn more about TrustMap at trustmap.com. You can find out more about Malcolm and Cymatic at cymatic.io. Our show was produced by Dan Rollins with Livewire Films. You can connect with Dan on LinkedIn and learn more about Livewire at livewirefilms.com. Stay tuned for the next episode of the Business of Security podcast. And that's a wrap.